Good morning. It's Monday. My name is Beth Pike, and I'd like to welcome you to Jaws of Justice Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. On today's edition, our host Greg LeBeau is going to be talking with psychologist Robert Barnett, and they're going to be talking about rights in court and prison of those suffering from mental illness. And then in our second half of the show, it's going to be Sunshine Smith. And Sunshine is going to talk with Professor Karen Curls, who is head of the sociology department, and also Lyle Gibson, a history instructor from Penn Valley Community College here in Kansas City. And they're going to be talking about civil rights tour of the South and how you can participate. So stay tuned for that and for a special 420 Drug War News in the middle of the show. And then we're going to do another one at the end of the show. So there'll be a second 420 Drug War News at the end. But coming up will be Craig LeBeau and his guest Robert Barnett.
Good morning. This is Craig LeBeau, and thank you for joining us on Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Robert Barnett, and he is a psychologist from Lawrence, Kansas. He has four offices through the state. Currently, he does evaluations for defendants who are facing incarceration in Kansas, and the evaluations are to determine if they, one, is if they're competent or not, and two, if they're suffering from mental illness that prevented them from having the intent to commit a crime. Previous to doing evaluations, and he's done several thousand of the evaluations, before that he was also a chief psychologist at Larned State Hospital. Larned is the hospital in Kansas that they use for those who are found not guilty by reason of insanity. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you. I need to correct one thing real quickly. I was not the chief psychologist at Larned. I was the chief psychologist in the Department of Corrections at the Reception and Diagnostic Unit.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you first, when you're doing these evaluations, first of all, what is the standard that Kansas applies?
Well, for competency?
For competency, and then more particularly for the mental illness is a defense.
Okay. As I understand it, and of course I'm not an attorney, but the issues of competency are usually settled informally by asking the individual if they understand the charges against them, the consequences of being found guilty, the roles of various members of the court, and then probably most important is whether or not they're willing and able to assist their attorney in their own defense. The issue of mental illness as a defense is a little more complicated in Kansas because, strictly speaking, as I understand it, we do not have not guilty by reason of insanity plea, but we do have issues of mitigation that can be addressed in sentencing. Do you want me to go a little further, or do you want me to pause here?
Well, let me say, in terms, first of all, as far as the competency issue, what do you do to determine if they are competent, as far if they understand and can assist the attorney in preparing their defense? I know oftentimes I have cases where they will be determined to be not competent by a psychologist locally here, and then the statute requires that they be sent to Larned for further evaluation until they become competent. And frequently those same people get to Larned, and the psychologist at Larned will send them back saying they're competent. So apparently the psychologists at local level are often using some sort of a different standard than what the Larned psychologist is. So how do we address that discrepancy?
Well, okay. Let's talk first They're basically two types of cases where competency is an issue. One is diminished intelligence, such as mild mental retardation or moderate mental retardation, and the other is active psychosis. And by psychosis, I mean hallucinations, delusions, and loss of reality contact. There are other circumstances, but these two groups make up the majority of cases where I'm asked to assess competency. Mental retardation and cognitive status is assessed easily with psychometric testing. The issue of psychosis is more likely to be decided through the interview and by what symptoms the person reports and what their behavior is like in the interview. One of the issues about sending people to Larned for competency evaluations is that they have access to sophisticated medications. And generally speaking, I would say these individuals are optimally medicated at Larned, which in many cases improves their functioning and makes them appear more competent. I should note that oftentimes when they're sent back to the local jails are not willing to pay for these medications, or they will pay for a different medication that is generic, and often these people deteriorate when they get back to the jail. And, of course, that's where they go to court from, so it's a problem. A separate issue is that Larned, if they believe that a person initially is not competent in the sense that they do not understand courtroom procedures or the charges, et cetera, what they will do is they will teach them these facts, sometimes with a video, sometimes through counseling. But it's been my experience that the gains from this type of teaching for people who are mentally retarded and psychotic are very short-lived, and usually by the time that I see them again, they've completely forgotten what they learned at Larned.
Okay, and let's address then the standard that's used to determine if they qualify for using mental illness as a defense. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the standard, in the past, most of the states used what was called the McNaughton standard, and that was simply if the defendant did not understand right from wrong. And then most of the states have migrated to a new standard, including Kansas, that to negate the intent and to show that the person didn't have intent, that you have to show his behavior was the product of mental illness or defect.
Well, tell us more about that. There's a problem here. The law changed several years ago with regard to intent, and now there are three aspects of intent, three levels of intent that I've, quite frankly, I do not understand. They're incomprehensible to me. I've asked many lawyers and even judges to explain them to me, and nobody's been able to do it. Part of the problem is, and I'm often asked to testify about this, you know, is was the person's illegal activity goal-directed and purposive? And I have to answer, yes, it was. It clearly was. But their ability to form intent is impaired, and it's not the same as a normal person would have. But the law is written, basically the only way that intent would be an issue is if the behavior, illegal behavior, was random or accidental. And it never is. It's always purposive.
Okay. And so how do you determine whether or not their mental illness is such that it has prevented them from having the requisite intent that's required by the statute, though?
Well, the key issue for those who are psychotic is whether or not they were actively psychotic at the time of the offense. And that would include experiencing command hallucinations where a hallucination, a person or a creature in a hallucination tells them to commit a particular crime or action. Along with that, people who are psychotic and particularly schizophrenics are typically paranoid, and by that I mean they are delusional. They have pronounced false beliefs, and one of the things that frequently happens in the case of paranoid schizophrenics is they will inexplicably attack somebody, and when you discuss it with them later, it's because they believe that person was going to harm them in some way or was planning to harm them, and it was what we would call a preemptive strike. This is not uncommon in my practice to see this type of issue arise. The persons who are mentally retarded are generally socially misperceptive and may commit crimes under the influence of someone else. In other words, they're easily led, or sometimes they simply don't understand what's going on around them and behave in what are seen as bizarre ways later.
Okay. Now, do you have any statistics on what percentage of the cases raise the mental illness defense and what percentage of that is successful?
Well, to answer your first question is I don't know because I don't have any way of comparison personally because I typically don't get cases where there isn't a mental health issue. I would say probably in 50% of the cases, the mental health issue that's raised, you know, by my diagnosis or my recommendations is at least has some impact on the court's decision, but often what happens, as you well know, Craig, is that we'll raise this issue in court, we'll have a hearing, and the outcome will be send them to Larned for further evaluation, and then the typical evaluation from Larned comes back that they're competent, that they're not mentally ill in a way that would mitigate the charges.
Okay. And procedurally, if they are found to be not able to form the intent based on mental illness, they're required, the next step is that they go to Larned for further evaluation. I believe it's a 90-day evaluation. What typically happens, and are the majority of them released, discharged after 90 days, or if not, how long do they typically keep them?
Well, bear in mind the evaluation, that's sort of a misnomer. Actual evaluation, face-to-face evaluation, would be maybe 2 days during that 90 days. Most of the time, it's observing them on the wards, their behavior and demeanor during the days, interactions with other inmates, etc. Here is the problem. Larned is pretty much stretched to the limit. They're very choosy about who they take for care and treatment, which is the logical outcome of being found incompetent. Consequently, we see a lot of these cases that are simply sent back to the court where the Larned says they are competent, their mental illness does not interfere with the case moving forward.
All right. What about, what I had in mind was a situation where the prosecutor in the court agrees and they find that they are, in fact, mentally ill and fit the diagnosis necessary to a requisite for using that as a defense.
Well, then the logical outcome would be a commitment to Larned, but again, Larned is the gatekeeper in these situations, and in many cases they will simply evaluate and return them to the court, saying they don't agree with, you know, the findings of other professionals in the court, and they won't take them. In some of these cases, what we've been able to work out with the prosecutor is have them go to a mental health nursing facility, of which there's probably half a dozen in Kansas. And actually, that's a fairly, in my opinion, that's a fairly practical way of dealing with this issue.
All right. And so I want to turn and talk a little bit about the mental illness of the inmate population. And let me just give the listeners a little bit of background here. Back decades ago, mentally ill patients were traditionally housed in state mental hospitals. Back in 1959, nearly 559,000 were housed in mental hospitals. But then there was a push for to deinstitutionalize them and do community-based treatment and get them out of the hospitals. And many of the hospitals, as a result, have actually closed because we don't need as many hospitals with the lower population. But a lot of these people now are ending up in jails and prisons. When you were at the Diagnostic Center as a chief psychologist there, what percentage of the inmates would you estimate were coming in with significant mental illness problems?
Well, this would have been in the 1986 to 1989 period, and I would say it was a relatively small percentage, probably no more than 10%.
Okay. And has that been increasing then?
Yes. Several years ago, I worked as a consultant to the Department of Corrections as a mental health program monitor, so I had access to all of their data regarding mental illness among inmates. And the percentage of inmates when I was there, it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, with a diagnosed mental illness, and this could include depression and anxiety disorders as well, but was up to 40%.
All right. And
I think that probably underestimates the true number.
Okay. And I would just, for a little bit more background, back in 2006, there was a special report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics that estimated there were 705,600 mentally ill adults incarcerated in state prisons, close to 79,000 in federal prisons, and approximately 500,000 in local jails. How is this happening? Is this a result of overzealous prosecutors that are prosecuting cases for minor things that are prompted by mental illness, or is this a result of the fact that we don't have hospitals to treat these people anymore, or is it lack of community services? I know the goal was to treat them in the community. Is there a problem with there not being the community services?
Well, let's start there. The original idea was pretty positive. It's pretty good. It was to take these people out of these old institutions and put them in community-based housing with community programs. They were never funded adequately, and they never worked very well, and they didn't have the staff, particularly of case managers and social workers, to have regular contact with these individuals to make sure where they were living and what they were doing. As I said, the big problem was it was never funded adequately. Just as a sideline, the same thing is true of the related program, the Home and Community-Based Services, for people who are physically impaired, and I believe the waiting list now for that is over 2 years. The other problem in the community is that, generally speaking, the only source of mental health services is the community mental health center. They as well are underfunded. They have a limited number of appointments available, and in many, many cases, these individuals who need these services, particularly medication, are waitlisted. I just heard in Wichita, I talked to a person from ComCare this last week, and they said they recently opened a walk-in clinic so individuals could immediately get medication. I really applaud that. That makes a whole lot of sense. But the other mental health centers simply are not able to do that. I think you asked me some other things, but I forgot what they were.
Well, let me ask you in terms of the lack of staffing and the lack of funding, is it fair to say, or is it am I under wrong impression that it would be a lot cheaper for the state to provide those services than to end up housing them later in prisons?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's primary and secondary intervention issues here. And by that, the analogy primary, a good analogy for primary prevention is brushing your teeth. Secondary prevention is getting your teeth filled, and tertiary intervention is having your teeth pulled. And in the United States, historically, we'd rather spend $100 to solve a problem than it would cost 10 cents to prevent. It's just the way we work in this country. I'm not sure why. But in any case, the costs of housing these people in prisons, roughly $30,000 a year for the average inmate. You could easily manage them on the street in a mental health center with appropriate follow-up for probably maybe 10% of that.
Okay. And so if we send these people to prison, though, if we wait till they commit a crime instead of giving them those services to possibly stop that from happening, what are the repercussions when we send them to the prison besides the money that's involved? How does it affect the inmate, and what happens to them then when they get out?
Well, you know, prison isn't an enjoyable place. Kansas prisons, quite frankly, are doing a pretty good job of managing mentally ill inmates. They have specific programs, particularly the TRU unit, TRU, Transitional Release Unit at Lansing, which is for the more vulnerable mentally ill. They have mental health services available at every facility, including mental health counselors as well as, you know, psychiatric medication support. Frankly, Kansas is probably one of the leaders in the country in this. But they have so many of them. The additional issue is when inmates act out, generally the punishment is to send them to what they call the hole, which is actually just segregation or isolation. They're in solitary confinement for a period of time. Unfortunately, this solitary confinement aggravates mental illness very badly. And a lot of times these people, as they come out, their behavior will be even worse, and it gets compounded, and then they're stuck in isolation or segregation for their entire sentence, which is not good for their mental health. I don't think anybody's really solved this problem. I'm sure you're aware there is a mental health facility for the correctional department out at Larned. It's not part of Larned State Hospital, but it's adjacent on the grounds. But many of the people out there are also in segregation, and I've been out there a number of times as part of my duties as a monitor, and I really saw most of these people as not improving due to the isolation.
Okay. We are just about out of time. We've got about 20 seconds left. And let me just ask you real quick. Is the recidivism rate higher among those who are mentally ill?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. If they don't get the proper support in the community, they'll be in trouble again.
So. Okay. All right. We are out of time, and thank you for joining us. We've been talking with Robert Barnett, psychologist in Kansas, who does evaluations on mentally ill people who are in legal troubles.
Okay.
Thanks
for inviting me.
This is the Blind Guy, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good morning. This is Sunshine, and I'm bringing you the second half of the Jaws of Justice program. This morning we'll be doing the Civil Rights Learning Community Tour, and Dr. Karen Curls, the division chair at Penn Valley Community College, will be my guest. I would like to give a shout-out to all my incarcerated loved ones and tell you to hold on, that it'll be all right.
and we'll see you when you get out. Dr. Curls, could you give us some information about what the Civil Rights Learning Community Tour is?
Well, first of all, let me say good morning, because you know you're one of my favorite people.
And I love you, too.
I'm so proud and happy to be here and very proud of you. The Civil Rights Learning Community Pilgrimage is part of our learning community on the Penn Valley campus for Metropolitan Community Colleges. We started this pilgrimage probably about 14 years ago. I was in the South, in Birmingham, and in the Civil Rights District. And after touring that, I thought it would be important to have our students to go down on an annual basis and actually have an opportunity to walk in the footsteps of those individuals who had come before us to really change the fabric of America. And so with the help of some African-American churches, and one being Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, at that time under the leadership of Wallace Hartsfield Sr., monies were provided, and we took our first trip. It was in August. It was hot, but it was well worth it.
I've personally been on three Civil Rights Learning Community trips to the South, and I have been to these sites. It's a very eye-opening, and it's a very rich and rewarding experience, and I would encourage everyone, for the small fee of either you can use your financial aid through community colleges or UMKC, or you can purchase it for $508, which is a nominal fee. Everyone has their own room, and it's a very, very rich experience. It will be life-changing, and you'll probably want to go again.
Because that's what you're going to do, right?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm on the bus for my fourth time. And the things that you learn just by walking in the footsteps. And when I watched President Barack Obama cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, I have pictures of myself walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge three times now. And I'm going for my fourth time. But it's something that you want to do in your lifetime, and to actually be in the places where these things happened. The Baptist church for the little girls where it was bombed, that they passed away. Birmingham is a very rich experience in the park over there with the statues. In Montgomery, Rosa Parks, the bus museum. There's so many things. And then, of course, Memphis on Beale Street and the Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King was killed. Dr. Curls?
Well, you know, Sunshine, you've really hit on some important landmarks that we travel. And every year we always go to Memphis because, as you've indicated, that was in 1968, the assassination of Dr. King. And that motel, was actually taken off of the foreclosure rolls by African-Americans attorneys and businessmen in Memphis. And so we always make a stop there because I think it's giving homage to persons who are, you know, really, really interested in what happened on that fateful day. And, you know, many of the places that we go, because we bring criminal justice and history together as a blended community, because we have a class, and the class goes from, you know, January to May. And in between, we always go in April on this pilgrimage. And so many of these places are actually crime scenes. The Lorraine Motel is a crime scene because we're looking at this assassination. When we go to Memphis, when we go to Birmingham, we also look at a crime scene because we're talking about the 16th Street Baptist Church. And so we're looking at where these four little girls were actually killed that Sunday morning in September. And so students have an opportunity to analyze this crime scene. One other point I want to make on that horrific day in September, you also had two little boys that were killed. They weren't in the church, but they were in the Birmingham area. And the Klan, in retaliation to the children's march that had taken place that May, that's why these children were killed, because all of this took place at the 16th Street Baptist Church. We are celebrating the 60th anniversary in December of the Montgomery bus boycott, which most people know as Rosa Parks refusing to get off the bus. We're celebrating also the Voter Rights Act, where last week we had President Barack Obama and others, thousands of others, I might add, to cross that infamous Edmund Pettus Bridge. And it always looks larger on television than when you actually walk across that bridge. But it's given students an opportunity to go on a insightful, moving pilgrimage to look at what changed in America during that period of time. You know, the government, through COINTELPRO, was quite active. And J. Edgar Hoover had basically wanted to neutralize a lot of different people who were outspoken, who were political. And what that meant was that with this neutralization, some of them will be assassinated. We have Fred Hampton, who was one of the Panthers. We had a lot of the Panthers that were, who became political prisoners during that time. We had King. We had Malcolm. We had a number of different things that were taking place during that eventful decade called 1960s. Medgar Evers. I mean, you name it, it was happening. So students have an opportunity to actually see some of these places, interact with some of the people. As you know, Sunshine, when we were in Birmingham, you had people who were at the church that day when that bombing took place, who were able to talk to our students and share that particular experience. So, you know, for about $508, you know, you can get on. You can get on the bus and basically move forward.
One of the things that I had no idea when I went to Penn Valley Community College, I had actually been in a wreck and was in a wheelchair when I started there, and I'm blessed now that I walk. But for me to even be a part of this the first time, several locations, because I am a child of the 60s and I was born in 1950 and stuff, I remember seeing these things on TV, but they became more real to me. And one of the things that when we went to Selma was that we get free time at each place, and we can walk around and talk to people, and it really brings it home. We ran into some older ladies that were planting flowers, and we stopped and asked them, and they told us about how that the white majority in Selma had closed all the gas stations, the grocery stores and stuff like that, but the black farmers brought in produce and things to make sure that the protesters that were there, over 200,000 of them, were fed, and that there was places for them to stay. Doors were opened for them. And each place that you go, you see these actual things that we've studied at different times in our schooling and stuff, and it becomes a very insightful and impactful on your life. It really encouraged me to go on and further my education, and I've got an advanced education, and I appreciate it, but I make sure that I try to come back every year and go wherever Dr. Curls is going.
Well, you know, and something that I don't want to fail to mention here is that this is a time when America, I mean, we're seeing a lot of racial tension taking place now in the United States. And we have to begin to look at, this was during a time in the 60s when the races started coming together. And there were black people who were killed, but there were also white people who were killed. And I don't want to let our listening, I want to let our listening audience know that. I mean, we had a minister that was killed. He had come down and he was beaten to death. He was clubbed to death by some of the Southerners. who did not want segregation to end. We had a Detroit housewife, Viola Luzzo, who came. She saw what was taking place. She got in her car, came down, and coming back from Montgomery to Selma, she was assassinated. She was murdered. So we're looking at the fabric of America changed in the 60s because people were willing to rise above, you know, race. They were able to rise above a culture. They were able to rise above religion. I mean, we had Jews. We had Protestants. We had Catholics. We had all these people coming together to really challenge America to change. And so I don't want that to be forgotten. And I think when we start looking at what this pilgrimage is all about, it basically strengthens our whole faith and belief that America is a country that, when put to the test, will do the right thing. And I think that we're seeing that now. We've got Ferguson on our places to kind of stop by, I guess, very quickly on our way to Memphis this year. But it's one of the places we're also going when we leave. I think it's Montgomery this year. We're going to go back up through Little Rock. And so we'll go to Central High School that the Little Rock Nine helped to integrate. We'll go to the Daisy Bates Interpretive Center. And Daisy Bates was one of those women of the civil rights. Oftentimes women aren't really talked about as it relates to the civil rights movement. But she was one of those strong women in Little Rock who basically helped to organize the Little Rock Nine. And, you know, oftentimes people who would come forward would lose a lot. I mean, they could lose their business. The houses could get bombed. Many of them were injured. They would lose jobs. But they were doing this because of a higher calling.
I've been, like I said, on several civil rights learning community trips, and we've gone different places, and I was on one where earlier we had went to Little Rock, and we also went to the Bill Clinton Presidential Museum, and we were able to, they fixed us dinner, and we sat by the river and the railroad bridge outside, and it was a beautiful setting, and it was so nice. They fixed us wonderful food. We have, I want to stress that the accommodations that we have, the bus that we go on is very comfortable. We have excellent drivers. We always have plenty of snacks, plenty of water, plenty of anything that usually somebody can snack on to get from one spot to the other. Our hotel rooms are always very nice. You always have a very good breakfast. We stop in very nice places, and we do wonderful things. And it really grows you as a person to go to these places. I've been to Eufaula and seen all the mansions, the beautiful mansions and stuff where the slaves were dropped off and the different things. I've been, and this is kind of like my personal vacation, as many years as I can do it. I want to stress that we become like a family. About a month ago, when I was at a funeral, I ran into a lady who had been on one of the civil rights learning community tours with me, and she brought up and she talked about everything. And this is an experience that you will hold for a lifetime, and I'm hoping it will make you hungry to go back, because she rotates it. We go different places every year, but this one is especially important this year because of the anniversaries and of the things that happen. And when you go and you sit in the church in Birmingham where the little girls were killed, and you see the stained glass windows, and you hear the stories of how they were repaired and sent back to the church, and it's been restored. And then
There's a museum across the street from the church there in Birmingham. And then around the corner, there was a motel where Martin Luther King had to stay because, of course, he was not allowed in the white downtown hotels. And it was in disrepair, but they were hoping to bring it back. But when you see the actual places, I'm sure it will be a very, very emotional, insightful trip for you. It's well worth anything that you spend in time and money.
You know, and for if people want further information, they could contact Metropolitan Community College's Penn Valley campus. And the number there is 604-4282. I think it's important also because people are thinking, well, you know, how does this really have to do with criminal justice? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the important things to realize that criminals can be looked at in various ways. And what we were seeing and what we're looking at is that, you know, some of the criminals were really part of the government. And so when we start talking about COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program that was the covert operation here in the United States, when we start looking at these crime scenes, when we start doing some of these different kinds of activities, it makes the criminal justice system really truly come to life. When you start talking about Bull Connor, when you start looking at the fact that you had children, over 5,000 children, that were actually taken into custody, when you start looking at people who were marchers, who were being targeted by the state of Mississippi and based upon, you know, being protesters and being arrested, their pictures, you know, they have mug shots and everything else. And so criminal justice becomes that discipline that takes on a totally different type of a look, a different type of approach where you can really begin to do a lot of critical analysis of what the system is all about and how it oftentimes works for you, and it can also work against you, particularly if you're looking at trying to address this issue of change. And my colleague, Mr. Gibson, has joined us, who is the other instructor, and he can share a little bit from a standpoint of the history of these various places that we go to and the significance of linking both the criminal justice aspect and the historical aspect together to, you know, bring education alive. And as Sunshine has indicated, where people really hunger for this. And you'd be surprised once you are on this pilgrimage where you want to learn additional kinds of information.
Yeah, with the history component.
Good morning, Mr. Gibson.
Good morning, good morning.
He's a history professor, and he's been on several of these, and he's a very, very good instructor. Mr. Gibson, please.
Yes, with the history component to our civil rights pilgrimage and our learning community, what I try to focus on is the history of laws in this country as they pertain to the African-American experience. And I maintain that no other demographic group in American history has not been so legislated other than African Americans. It begins with colonial statutes, colonial laws, black codes. And then when we get to the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, our founding fathers did not want to address the term slavery. However, with regards to the peculiar institution, we know that slavery was a part of the U.S. Constitution. And so with the civil rights pilgrimage, what we try to do is engage students in looking at these different places in time, these different southern cities within the context of the African-American experience, voting rights issues, civil rights issues. Why were American citizens, some 20 million or so by the 1950s and 60s, why were they denied basic constitutional rights? And I think when we look at this, it really helps students get an appreciation for not only the history, but where we are today.
Lyle, when you were on the trip with us that I was on, and I would like for you to tell people about how everybody kind of interacted with everybody, and you brought that different dynamic of the history where Dr. Curls brought the criminal justice, but you were very informative also with the other participants on the buses. And how many times have you been?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you've been.
Too many to count right now.
Yeah. You know, and it's something that we do every spring. This is what we do, those of us that have gone. And, you know, when I come to Penn Valley, I always stop in and speak to Lyle because he's very involved with the criminal justice and the history of it. And from what I've heard from other people that I've helped get in Penn Valley, he's very informative in his history classes also. I guess that have you been to Montgomery?
Yes.
With us, and you've been to each one of these places, because I think we went to Little Rock, and I think, did you go to Tuskegee? We've been to Tuskegee.
Yes.
To the university.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm dusting off the archives here, so y'all bear with me. And when we go to the different places, it's nice to have, I mean, we always love Dr. Curls, but for you to join in and come on, I would like to tell you that I appreciated you being on the trips with us. And have you brought it up in your classes to people about coming to on this Civil Rights Learning Community Tour this year?
Yes, I mention it every year to my classes, fall and spring semester classes. I do mention that and encourage students to participate in these classes. And one of the things, too, I just wanted to piggyback off what you said. The history component is so important because it, you know, we look to that old saying, those who do not recall the past are condemned to repeat it. And so understanding the historical aspect is very important as we go on these trips.
And I would like to encourage everyone to contact Penn Valley Community College and for them to ask about the Civil Rights Learning Community Tour. It's once a year. It's a few days. It's 4 days. We'll be on Thursday, April the 23rd. We'll be in Memphis. Friday, April the 24th, we'll be in Selma. Saturday, April the 25th, we'll be in Montgomery. And Sunday, April the 26th, we'll be in Birmingham. And then we'll be back into Kansas City and back to Penn Valley. We leave from Penn Valley Community College on that Thursday, early morning. And in the evening time, we get to Memphis. I would encourage everyone to call 816-604-4282 at Penn Valley Community College, and we will they will be able to give you information on how to get on the Civil Rights Learning Community Tour. I would like to thank Dr. Karen Curls and Lyle Gibson for coming and being my guests this morning. And I would encourage everyone to continue to listen to the Jaws of Justice on Mondays from 9 to 10. And if you have any input, please call the station. And also, if there's anything that I could do for you, my number is 816-372-1288. I work in the streets. I work with formerly incarcerated citizens. I do not call us what the other people call us, because we're trying to gain our rights back. And an education is the best way to stay out of prisons and jails. Thank you, Dr. Curls, and thank you, Lyle.
Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The Reverend Pat Robertson.
God gave you and me as human beings authority. He gave us dominion over everything on this earth, over all the animals, all the plants, all the vegetables. Marijuana is a vegetable, and yet people are enslaved to vegetables. Why would you become a slave to a vegetable?
With the help of Monty Python, I'd like to relay to you the latest government objection to the legalization of marijuana.
Rabbits.
Too late. Get ease. Where's the ordinary rabbit? That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on.
The Washington Post reports that DEA agent Matt Fairbanks is deeply concerned about the impact of marijuana on our nation's flowers, fauna, and rabbits.
Marijuana grows with rabbits that had cultivated marijuana, where one of them refused to leave us, and we took all the marijuana around him, but his natural instincts to run were somehow gone.
God Almighty can deliver you from the bondage of your addiction, your slavery to vegetables. He can set you free.
The following segment was recorded in San Francisco at the International Cannabis Business Conference.
Matthew Shoemaker with Steep Hill Halen. We're a cannabis analytical laboratory, and we have several labs located throughout the country. And our main lab is in Berkeley, California right now. But we have labs in Washington, Colorado, and Nevada, and soon to open in New Mexico. We do anything from residual solvents to mold, potency, all sorts. Anything that needs to be tested in the medical and marijuana industry, we'll do it. Well, there's great medical aspects with CBD, with seizures and loss of appetite. If you need CBD, it helps you a lot.
If you would, please share your website where folks can learn more about the work you guys do.
It's steephilllab.com, and it has all our various information on our new gen kit. It has our instant potency analysis machine, the Quantican 2, and it also gives great bios of our chemists and chief research officers that work with us.
At first, they said marijuana leads to insanity, criminality, and death, but now it leads to rabbits being addicted. What do you think? Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. Sitting here in my prime. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical. I can, and if I fall down,
okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better.